This is Vince Horsman recounting a time in the 1980s in Ipswich when I was a volunteer fireman. And it's called A Night in the Life of a Volunteer Fireman. The call came at 4 on a cold winter's morning as I slept soundly in my bed. I could never adjust to the strident tones from my pocket pager. As usual on these occasions, I thrust it under my pillow while I pulled my trousers over the top of my pyjamas, donning a pullover as quickly as I could. I quickly made my way downstairs. Outside my house, the car responded quickly and I pulled away into the dark, silent streets. Even the street lamps were extinguished so late on this cool, still night. As I turned the corner, I saw in the distance column of smoke rising vertically from the sleeping town, and my drive took on a more urgent pace. This was no standby on station call. As I reached the bottom of the road, I had to brake silently as a fire engine tore across the junction, a mass of blue lights and silver bodywork. I followed it as far as I could, but it was soon lost to view. As I got near to the fire station, I recognised other part-time firemen making their way there at breakneck speed. Nothing prepared me for the scene which greeted me as I pulled into the street where the fire station was. It was an old building built at the turn of the century for horse-drawn appliances. But 100 metres beyond this, a mass of flames and smoke belched from the back of an as yet unknown building, largely lost to view. I braked hard and parked the car as quickly as possible, paying no regard to the no parking signs, silently praying that the fire sign in the car window would protect me from all but the most enthusiastic traffic wardens. Several of us arrived at the station door at the same time, and when the door was opened, we went straight into action. By now, the station was full of men frantically pulling on boots and leggings. The main doors swung open and the 13-ton Bedford water tender ladder rolled out into the quiet street. The appliance only had seats for 6 men, but on this occasion 11 firemen attended the fire, 5 running alongside. We arrived at the rear of the building, a general hardware shop, in one of the oldest and most densely built up areas of the town centre. The fire was through the roof and the building was well alight. Even at this early stage, we knew that nothing could save it. Hoses were immediately run out from the now stationary appliance towards the rear of the burning 15th century building. I grabbed a coil of hose and, coupling it to the previously laid length, ran it to the doorway leading into the shop. My colleague, a leading fireman, second in command of our crew, broke down the back door with an axe and returned to help me with the jet. By this time, I'd engaged the nozzle into the last section of the hose, and with us both holding the jet, he gave the order, "water on," to the fireman operating the pump. Instantly, a stream of water shot through the shattered doorway and was swallowed up by the roaring flames behind. I suggested entering the blazing building to get closer to the seat of the fire, but was told firmly to stay where I was. Within a few minutes, there was a muffled explosion as a gas cylinder burst and flames engulfed the area where I would have been standing had I been given my way. By now, several more fire engines had arrived at both the front and the rear of the building. Dozens of hoses lay on the ground like giant spaghetti strands, the pattern broken only by the occasional damaged coupling, producing a fine spray of water, in turn casting rainbow halos around the lights of the parked vehicles. The streets at both front and back of the building were now jammed with emergency vehicles, each with their blue lights sweeping the walls and windows of surrounding shops and dwellings like demented lighthouses. With a crash, I was brought back to reality as the roof collapsed and fell into the middle of the conflagration. with the supply of oxygen suddenly increased. The fire gathered apace and the building was ablaze from wall to wall in a short time. The battle to save the shop was lost, but the fight with the fire was far from over. If the wind picked up, we could easily lose the whole street. This part of town was mostly timber-framed houses and a very high fire risk. Ladders were used to get above the fire and direct jets of water onto the walls to try and stop it spreading to adjacent properties. We laboured hard and long, making steady progress against the ever-hungry flames. One of our crew, an inexperienced young man, slung a hose onto his shoulder and climbed a short ladder leant against the shop's back wall. This particular hose nozzle, a control branch, could be turned on and off by means of a lever, and when he reached the top of the ladder, he turned it on. The jet of water propelled him backwards and brought both himself and the ladder down onto the heads of a senior fire officer and myself. Chaos ensued as we tried to disentangle ourselves from the ladder. I grabbed the snaking hose, which was soaking anyone within 6 or 7 metres. We were all right, except the novice, whose pride was badly bruised by the incident. Soon our efforts began to bear fruit. The first sign was the sudden shock of a jet of water full in my face from another fireman's hose at the front of the building. My comments left him in no doubt as to my feelings on this uncalled-for refreshment. Gradually, I became aware of a change in the colour of the surrounding skyline as the new day began to dawn. A television camera crew picked their way among the hoses, looking for suitable vantage points for filming. For a few seconds at a time, their brilliant cine lights illuminated the dark buildings and scattered grotesque shadows around the site. After a few minutes they were gone, no doubt rushing the film by dispatch rider to the nearest studios for the next TV news bulletin. Entering the shell of the building, we started the slow process of damping down and extinguishing small pockets of flame in the ancient building. The mess was appalling. Windows were reduced to pools of molten glass. Charred ceiling timbers dripped water onto our helmeted heads, although surprisingly the staircase to the first floor was still intact. Climbing this, we started to clear the debris from the building into the car park at the back. Walking gingerly across the weakened floor, I was suddenly caught around the throat by a strand of copper wire on which I swung involuntarily before extricating myself. As it transpired, at the height of the fire, the collapsing roof had left what remained of the electrical wiring hanging unnoticed like a deadly noose for unwary visitors. The building was partly brick-built, and it was necessary to pull the bricks away to expose pockets of burning material as yet unquenched by our jets. I pulled away some of the bricks with the pick end of my axe when suddenly the entire wall toppled towards me. With surprising speed, considering my exhaustion, I sidestepped out of danger as mortar and bricks tumbled beside me. Within half an hour, the signal came to evacuate the building. Thousands of gallons of water had been sprayed from all sides onto the first floor, and it was seriously weakened to the point of collapse. I climbed down the stairs and out into the front street. A van was serving tea and sandwiches to weary firemen, and I joined the queue. It was now that the tiredness and cold struck me. As any fireman will tell you, this is the most depressing time on the fire ground. A relief crew turned up and took over our fire engine and equipment. We didn't have to clean any of it, having spent all night getting it dirty. Later that evening, my family and I watched myself on television with firefighting colleagues tackling the biggest blaze in our town for many years. I didn't leave it long before I turned into bed, hoping that my pocket pager would remain silent for 10 hours at least.